Dean Shepherd, author, raconteur, and commentator of the contemporary scene. Here's Gene.
We would like to take the occasion tonight, before we go any further, we would like to salute a lady who had the ultimate ding-dong happen to her in, of all places, no surprise, Los Angeles, Mrs. Dorothy Irwin, a lady near Los Angeles, a place out there named Sylmar. Her house was destroyed by mistake Wednesday. Mrs. Dorothy Irwin had lived in this house for a long time, but she left it unoccupied since the earthquake. A little damage on it, so she moved out, you know, until they had it fixed. She said she received a call from a former neighbor who lived next door to the house or around the house early Wednesday, telling her that a bulldozer was being unloaded onto her property. Mrs. Irwin quickly got dressed and drove the 2 miles to the house from the San Fernando apartment in which she is now living. She arrived too late.
It couldn't have been more than 30 minutes between the time I was informed of it and when I arrived, she said. But the house was already torn down.
She said she ran up to the contractor, who was standing around on the job smoking cigars, and shouted, "What are you doing?" She said the man asked her if this was not a Raven Street house that he had contracted to demolish under the earthquake demolition program of the Federal Office of Emergency Preparedness.
"No,"
I told him.
"This address is 13603 Eldridge Avenue,"
Mrs. Irwin said.
"He told me not to worry about it. The insurance would cover the damage."
All I gotta say is, could you imagine some poor insurance guy sitting there? He says, "They did what? They want us to cover what? With a bulldog? You mean the wrong address?" Listen, that's worse than almost. That's almost as bad. You know, I have a friend who's a dentist. They had a joke, of course, among dentists, is always the hypothetical dentist that pulls the hypothetical wrong tooth. Well, my friend told me the other day, this dentist friend of mine, he was ashen, he was shaking. And I said, "What's the matter, John?" And he said, "Well, I don't know how to tell you." And I said, "Well, what happened, John?" He said, He said, "Well, you heard me talk about Wesley." And I said, "Yes, I have heard you talk about Wesley. Wesley is the cut-up dentist. You see, among any group of professional men, there's always the guy who is more or less the, let's put it this way, he's a barrel of fun type. You know, there's one doctor who comes in and walks up behind another doctor and says, 'Boo, what is this?' And with that, he whips out a fresh set of just freshly removed appendices, and whips them down into his doctor friend's. he's eating the funiculi with the tomato sauce, and the next thing you know, he's got, you know, oh yeah, that's Dr. Humor. I'm just telling you what Dr. Humor's like. Oh yeah, yeah, that's right. Don't worry, honey, I'll do that. All right, my friend John, see, he says, yeah, he says, you know Wesley. And I said, yeah, I heard you talk about Wesley. He says, you know, Wesley's the funny dentist, see? And he's the kind, you know, was always giving his dental assistant a hot foot, you know, that kind, pretending he's giving her Pedithol, you know, like, you know, ha ha, whoa, you know, he comes running in with a great big, yeah, he says, one of the things he did one time he has a very nervous patient, you know, some people are very nervous about dentists, you know, and it's a very nervous a guy. So one day, Wesley, Dr. Wesley, wearing his jazzy white coat, you know, being the dentist, he has this mirror on top, and he lowers the light down over the nervous patient, and he says, Miss Mortimer, please, would you please handle me nutpick number two? And she gives him nutpick number two, and he digs in his mouth, and he says, light, please. And he lowers the light a little bit. Then he says, hypodermic, please. And he reaches behind him. She hands him this hypodermic. Well, he has a veterinary friend. And the veterinary friend had given him a hypodermic, the kind they use on hippopotamuses. As, you know, when a hippopotamus has bad joints or something. A tremendous, fantastic, gigantic, lethal-looking, totally deadly-looking hypodermic. Weighed about 7 pounds, came in a shoulder holster, had a needle at least 14 inches long with prongs on it, you know. And he takes this thing out, see? And he says, he just holds it up like that. He's going to stick this guy. He says, the guy is being tight-lipped, see? He doesn't want to pretend nothing's happening, see? And he says, he sees the pupils of his eyes contract with the total fear, but he's sitting there very tight. He says he could hear his jockey shorts going twang, twang, out of fear. And he says, gigantic thing. And he plays it absolutely cool, see? And he says, Miss Mortimer, 225 cc, please, solution number 12. But she turns around with the hypodermic. She's got a great big jug, and she goes, sucks it all up in the hypodermic. And he had made this purple-green, gloppy-looking solution, see? Well, all right, that's the kind of humor this guy's got, okay? You can see, it's really basic bad news humor, right? I mean, you know, that's the kind of stuff. So they had a good laugh, you know, and they sat around and drank Lavoras for half an hour and got bombed out of their skull, and you know how it is. So, nevertheless, this same guy, my friend John, says, well, you know how Wes is, you know. And I said, yeah, I do know how Wes is. He says, you know, Wes is always playing gags, right? And I says, well, I don't know. I mean, if you can call that giant hypodermic a gag, you know, I don't know. I mean, looks like he's got a little Adolf Eichmann blood in him, see, or something. And he says, you know what happened to Wes the other day? And I said, no. He says, well, Wes has got this very elegant lady, you know, who comes in there all the time, and he's been working on this case, and he has all the x-rays out. And Wes is about to start work again. She's been coming in there like 15 times. And so he gets to go. He gets working away there. And he's extracting a tooth. You got it, right? Extracting a tooth. He says, so he gets everything ready. He gets everything gone away. He gets all the stuff, the anesthesia going, everything like that. Everything's going groovy, see? So he reaches in. He goes, that's it. That's neat, see? Everything worked just according to Hoyle. So he puts all his stuff back into the tray, you know, and the girl is, all of a sudden, Miss Mortimer comes over and says, Dr. Wes. And he says, yes. She says, the wrong one. He says, the wrong one. She says, the wrong one. You pulled the number 6SJ7 incisor. It was the number 6SJ7GT incisor. He says, what do you mean? She says, you pulled the wrong one. It was then that he realized what he had done. That horrible moment. He had the names alphabetically, all neatly, in his x-ray file. And he had pulled out the one right next to her, alphabetically. And he had pulled the wrong tooth. And there she's laying there, see?
I says, John, what happened then? What did he do?
He says, don't ask. I says, I won't. And so I would like to tell you, friends, I ask. I don't know what happened at that point. All I know is that the thing that Wes had always been laughing about all the other dentists, see, every time he would meet another dentist, he'd say, ah, well, pull any wrong tooth lately? Wes is the only guy who actually did it. So I want to tell you, friends, there's a lesson in this for all of us. There's a real lesson in it for all of us. And that is, don't horse around. That's a shepherd's lesson for today. Would you please listen to that? Don't horse around. Now, I could just be horsed around here, you know, and pretending like I was Uncle Don. And, you know, wouldn't it be funny if I said, don't horse around. Do not horse around. Did I ever tell you about the friend that I knew? The friend of mine who is to this day, his life is ruined to this day. Ruined, because he horsed around. Horsing around. You get into trouble, more trouble, horsing around than any other thing. Yeah, any other thing. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you one thing. A friend of mine, who is now working in Chicago, by the way, he's got a big TV show there. And I know, God knows where he could have gone if he hadn't done this. I mean, he could have gone. He could be working in, you know, some big place by now. But he, yeah, that's right. You know what he did? He was doing the morning news. He's a staff announcer, you know. And he was doing the morning news on this radio station. And he'd come in every morning, like at 6 o'clock, you know, he'd at 5 a.m., and he'd do the 6 o'clock news. They had this big morning show. See, and he'd do the 6 o'clock news, and he'd do the 7 o'clock news. No 5-minute newscast. You know, just strictly staff. Well, the big newscaster came on at 8. You know, the big guy, you know, like Lyle Vann on the human side of the news. You know, some big type announcer would come in and do the news. You know, newscaster. That's different from an announcer. So he's sitting around there. He's bored. You know, it's 7:45. And this guy was a real stiff. Totally stuffed shirt type, you know, the guy that comes on at 8. Yeah, he was the kind of guy that clears his throat for, 15, 20 minutes before he goes on. And he has little megaphones attached to his ears so he can hear his own voice, you know. 1, 2, 3, 4. Good morning, Americans. He'd practice it. Yeah, he'd sit in his little room in there. He had a room, attached to the news machines. He'd say things like, good afternoon, Americans. And he's very good at that kind of thing. Went on to become very big, and now he says it even more. He's on the network and everything now, the same guy, see. He says, good afternoon, Americans everywhere. That kind of thing. He's got elegant style, see. Or one of his great lines is, are we, the American taxpayers, consulted? And so ends my open letter to the president. Good afternoon, Americans everywhere. He's always writing open letters to the president. You know, that takes guts. But nevertheless, he's that type, see? So and thoroughly hated, by the way, by the rest of the staff. He was such a totally pompous fake Newton that, you know, he made your teeth squeak just to look at him. Yeah, he put starch in his Fruit of the Loom shorts, you know, that kind of a guy. You know, he's very, very, very square John. So nevertheless, my friend Wally, we will call him that for want of a better name, yes, he's a real pippy-poo type. He's sitting at the typewriter in the newsroom waiting for his shift to end. He's been on since about 3 in the morning, bored out of his bird and half asleep. And he types up this bulletin. Just a bulletin. You'd think anybody would realize it's a gag. You know, he types it up on newspaper. It says, Washington, all National Guard and all training units and all units of the U.S. Army were today mobilized at 7 a.m., period. By order of the president, period. That's it. He just left it there. See, well, not anyone, you know, come on. That would be all over the news. You know, I would be in 5,000 reams a copy. Bells would ring everywhere if that happened, right? Well, do I have to ask you what Square John did? No, well, he didn't do what you thought he did. He didn't come in and put it on the air. No, he got this thing, see? Well, he thinks he's very important. See, the one thing about Square Johns is they always think everybody's spying on them. Yes, this is a form of ego to believe the FBI is spying on you. You have to think of yourself as very important to believe that the FBI would be spying on you. You know, this is for you. Oh, yeah, that's a kind of a paranoia. So anyway, he comes in there and he finds this note. What do you think he did? He called the FBI and said that a saboteur
has placed in his news files an erroneous false message which would cause panic in the United States. Now, wait a minute. This guy's on a little 250-watt peanut whistle. In Midwest, can you imagine planting a panic in the United States? Guy, man, that's how important he thought his newscast was. It caused panic. People would run out of the streets. Oh, we are being attacked. Did you hear the 8 a.m. news? Oh, we're being attacked.
250-watt.
We were down, our station was so far down the dial at that time, Nick, that our listening audience competed rather unfavorably with the police calls. And then, in fact, we were down around in that frequency. I think we were just about this side of shortwave. We were down there where there were little birdies and whistles, you know, and once in a while you'd hear radiators banging in the background, all kinds of noises. So anyway, he called the FBI. Within 5 minutes, the 18 agents come, you know, after all, it's a radio station. And they go around, and they have, they powder things on, you know, to find out where the, you know, where... All the while, Wally's back home in his room in the Y. You know, he's trying to get some sleep. He figures his little gag, and that's the end of it, see? Well, 15 minutes later, and I have to tell you what happened. Yes, indeed. So, yeah, they yank him out, you know. He's a saboteur and all this stuff. You know, he's trying to panic the United States. Well, nevertheless, Dick, what is this from? Horsing around. All right, tonight's show is about... That elusive human thing called horsing around. Now, I submit to you, the guy with a bulldozer might have been horsing around. I imagine for years, these guys with the bulldozers said, what do you think, Charlie? One day, you know, we knocked out a wrong house, you know. Well, horsing around. Now, I'm going to tell you a terrible story. This is a true story, and I'm going to tell it to you, and I'm going to lay it out just the way it was. And it's the ultimate horsing around horror story. The ultimate horsing around horror story. And incidentally, may I point out that horsing around is often the direct product of boredom. Yeah, you know it, man. Oh, you know it. You sit around and master control long enough, and you're bored out of your bean. You know, you can hear your head. You can actually hear it turning to sauerkraut. You know, your brain is beginning to ferment. That with just plain stagnation, you are a human swamp, brackish water. And have you ever had the feeling your head has been asleep for a while? You know, once in a while you can hear a bubble in your brain, bloop, bloop, and up comes this rare poison gas that seeps out of your ears. You know, well, nevertheless, this is the ultimate thing. This is what causes horsing around. Because it's a desire, a secret desire to blow up the place, is what really it stems from. Well, where is boredom raised to a fine art? I mean, outside of, you know, the 24th floor here. I mean, where is boredom raised to a fine art? That's right. You are correct, Demo. I discovered new dimensions in boredom when I was in the Army. No, there ain't no civilian can even remotely touch on the subject of boredom when he's around anyone who has spent any time, any length of time, in any one of the major services. I mean, because boredom, I can remember, you know, being so bored, you reach a point in boredom where you don't even know you're bored anymore. It's just like does a hamster know it's a hamster just squatting in a cage? Eating seeds, you know, year after year, just squatting and belching, and that's it? A hamster? No! Have you ever looked at an animal and say, what? You know, gee, it must be boring just to be a dog. What is a dog? Does he just walk around? Doesn't he ever read? No, you know, see, he's so bored, I mean, his boredom is so profound that he doesn't even know he's bored anymore. Well, that's the way it is in the Army a lot of times, see? Well, a few years ago, when I was working in another city, and I'm not going to tell you the name of the city, I was broadcasting. I did a nightly, like a nightclub show. See, I never did studio stuff much, and I was always doing on-stage broadcasts and stuff, you know, like the Limelight and that. And I was broadcasting from a big nightclub restaurant in this city. And it was a big show, and, you know, live up on stage and all that stuff. And the guy that ran it, he had a curious, morose quality about it. I couldn't pinpoint it. Now, the place would be filled with, riotous customers buying everything but the tablecloths, you know, which they stole. Just squirting money, and he'd still walk around. He had a morose look in the eye, see? So one night, after the show, I'm sitting there, and we're through. See, the place is emptied out, and I walk down through the empty tables after the show and is over, and the guys are sweeping up, and I'm walking through the tables, and all of a sudden I see over in the corner, I see Cy sitting over there. See, I'll call him Cy, okay? It's a silly reason to call him that. Well, actually, his name was Cy, but I see Cy sitting over there in the corner, and I said, "How are you, Cy?" See, and he said, "Okay." And we had a great night, and the place had been packed. I said, money flowing in, people yelling and screaming, drinking champagne out of slippers and the whole bit, you know. And I said, "How are you, Cy? What, what's up?" He said, "Sit down and have a drink." So I said, "Yeah, okay, Cy." And this is one of the punishments of working in nightclubs. You always got to have a drink with a boss. And, due to the fact that it's such an ingrained habit with him, he instinctively waters your drink, even when you're having one with him, see. So I sit down there, and he said, "What do you have?" And I says, "Jack Daniel." Well, I knew I wasn't going to get that. It's a bar whiskey that his friend Fred W. Barr makes in his basement down the street, see. And, they make it out of pure alky, They put a little caramel syrup in it, and OD bourbon. And I'm sitting there drinking this rot gut, and I finally came out with it. I said, "Cy, what's eating you anyway?" I says, "It's late at night. I was feeling pretty good, so I figured, well, what the hell? Let's blow the gaff." I said, what's bugging you anyway? Why is it?" He said, "What do you mean?" That's what, Cy, I said, "I know you a long time, and you walk around here, and in the middle of everything, guys are hitting you on the back and screaming and yelling, and you got the biggest thing in this town since bottled beer, and the Copa would be jealous of you. What's bugging you?" "I don't know what you mean." I said, "Well, okay, Cy, you don't want to talk about it. All right, it's over me. It's okay, There's nothing that makes a guy want to talk quicker than to pretend you don't give a damn about it. See, I was beginning to discover that principle, so I says, "All right, okay." It's probably dull anyway, Boring story. "How about another drink, Cy?" And so he says, hey, Luigi, another drink here. By the way, when he called the waiter Luigi, that means water it double. If he called him Fernando, that means, slip a Mickey in it. So he says, "Hey, Luigi, another one here for Shep here." So I'm sitting there waiting, and then he starts to... He's all right. He says, "I'll tell you what it is. I'll tell you. He says, I was in the Army." I said, "Yeah, so was I, Cy." He says, "Well, you know how bored you get in the Army?" And I says, "Yes, Cy, I do." He says, "Well, I'll tell you." He says, I was assigned to an island." And he said, "It was just a little island way out in the middle of the Pacific. Me and another bunch of guys, about 25 guys, in a Signal Corps radio teletype relay company." And I said, "Oh, God." He says, "Yeah, you have no idea. Relay. We didn't even invent messages. We relayed them." He says, "That's all." He says, "And there was nothing else on the island." He says, "There were a couple of toads." He says, "There were half a dozen... guinea pigs running around." He said, "They have big guinea pigs out there." "Yeah, they really do, out the Pacific. Did you know that? They got big, fat rodents." And he says, "They were all male, which even made it worse." He said, "You had female guinea pigs." And he says, "And there was no beach." He says, "Everybody thinks of the South Pacific as a beach, No beach." He says, our "Nothing but cliffs all around." He says, "If you ever tried to swim, forget it. Between the sharks... And the fact that the water was filled with little sharp things that cut your feet," he says, "there was no beach, there was nothing." He says, "It was 150 degrees there all the time." And he said, "When it wasn't 150 degrees, it was 190. And when it wasn't 190, it was raining. And then it was 210. He says, "It actually rained the boiling water." He says, "So we're sitting there." He says, "The first year goes by," and he said, "one ship went by us." He says, "We could see it out on the horizon, like 400 miles away. And everybody went down to the cliff. and looked at it through spy glasses. It was a ship passing on the horizon. I said, where did it go? He says, I don't know. It just went over the horizon and disappeared. Never come there. I said, well, how did you get your supplies? He says, once every 6 months, a whole bunch of planes would fly over and drop stuff on them. He says, most of it would go in the ocean. I said, well, how long were you there? He says, well, he says, I was there going on to 3 years. And he says, now I want to tell you, it was unbelievable. He said, so one morning, he says, it's like 6:55 in the morning. I'm sitting there at the teletype machine, and the messages are coming in and going out. They go... they go from the War Department, and they go out to MacArthur. Ding, 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 ding. He says, now I'm watching the thing. Ding, ding, ding. And I'm running the machine, that's all. It's just going on and on through. And he says, now, we had a teletype. We could type a message if we wanted to and put it in on the line. He said, and we had these machines all sitting around with keyboards on them. He said, and so my friend Aki is sitting on the other side of the tent, and he's got a keyboard, right? He says, so we plug it up so that I can send the message to Aki. And so Aki is sending me dirty stories on his teletype, see? And it goes ding, 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 and I'd laugh, see? So I send him a dirty story. Ding, 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 and they're going back and forth, see? He said, so Aki gets a real funny idea. He goes, ding, 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 ding. Today, 17 GIs blew up General MacArthur. Ding, 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 ding. And he says, ah, we laugh at that one, see? So I think of a funny joke. So I say, ding, 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 ding. Today, the war ended all over the world. Ding, 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 report. Hitler has surrendered. Ding, 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 signed Ike. Ding, 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 General Eisenhower. Ding, 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 the war in Europe is over. Ding, 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 6SJ7. And he signs the secret War Department code, which means high priority message all the way to the Supreme Headquarters. He thought it was a gag, see? And he just sent it over to his friend Aki. Aki left and left it in the machine. They go off shift. Now they're laying in their tent asleep, see? It is now 8:30 in the morning. They go off the shift at 8. When all of a sudden my friend wakes up with the sweat pouring and he hears cannon fire. Boom! Pow, pow! He hears guys go, wah-hoo-hoo-hoo! Boom, boom! Boom, boom! He wakes up and across the tent from him is Aki. He says, Aki, Aki. Aki says, what are you doing? Boom, boom. He says, Aki, listen, they're firing at our island. What the hell's going on? Aki opens the tent and looks out, and he sees a lot of naked GIs running around shooting their 45s up in the air. Kapow, pow, they're screaming. The lieutenant is running, throwing his helmet up in the air. And Aki wanders out and says, what's the matter? And the guy says, didn't you hear, Aki? The war is over. It's over. We get the message from the Supreme Headquarters. And Aki says, yeah, really? And for 5 minutes, Aki celebrated. And then it hit him. It was his message. And the reports are filtering through. Somebody came into the tent at 8 o'clock in the morning, saw that message in Aki's teletype machine, and says, for crying out loud, you mean them nuts last night didn't relay this on? He says, they tore it up, they relayed it on to Eisenhower, they relayed it on to General MacArthur, to Admiral Nimitz, and all over the Pacific, guys are celebrating, blowing up bombs in it. And the war was no more over, friend, than 1972 was over. And they had started the whole damn thing, horsing around. Well, the people are cheering, guys are running around, saying, when will I get home? Oh, my God! And my friend Cy goes down to the headquarters tent. And sitting in there is their captain, bombed out of his skull. He's drinking, yelling, sit down, Cy, the war is over. How are you, boy? And Cy says, well, Captain, that's what I come to talk to you about. He says, what do you mean, come to talk to me? Sit down, Cy. Hey, Cy, how about a drink? Hey, Cy, I'm going to make you a captain. Come on, what the hell, the war's over. He says, wait a minute, Captain, excuse me, Captain, about that message. About that message, And outside, the ships of now, Nimitz's fleet is coming over the horizon, firing its guns in celebration. Kaboom! Kaboom! Star shells are going up. Planes are flying overhead doing barrel rolls. You know, the guys are he spot that message, Captain. don't get mad now. It's you know... One thing about you, Cap, you know, honestly, you got a sense of humor, right? Well, that message, I typed it out and sent it to Aki. He says, well, yeah, well, why don't you send it out to headquarters? For crying out loud, it's the only thing going. He says, no, I just typed it. I invented it. I sent it to Aki. He said, you what? He said, I sent it to Aki. He said, oh, my God, quick, get MacArthur on the phone.
You've been listening to Gene Shepherd, author, raconteur, and commentator on a contemporary scene.